Blog Talk Radio.
Getting It Right with Dr. Bowles. Good afternoon, my radio listeners. I'm so glad to have you join me here March 12, 2015. I do hate when a month starts on a Sunday. It seems it moves so much quicker than when it starts in the middle of the week. With all that said, I'm very glad to be with you today. Today's topic has to do with behavioral modification social models. And I spent a lot of time in the marquee giving a little background. I'm working with a nonprofit organization. I write grants and review grants. And the one I'm working on now is most interesting for a number of reasons. One is too often when we get federal funding, they're looking to an academic institution to do what is required to be done by grassroots organizations or even community-based organizations, and a lot of money is spent, and they lament the failures of these various programs. And it is my opinion, shared by who study what they call the problem, are often too removed from the day-to-day impetus or causes of these problems, such that they really don't make contact to the very people they're supposed to help. So in today's talk, I do a couple of things. I give you a little background. In case you didn't know, to date, the United States clings to a concept of what's called rugged individualism. That sounds good. If you're a fan of John Wayne, it feels good to say it. If you are all bravado and you like to think you pull yourself up by your bootstraps, that's jargon that sounds good. The reality is when you're in a nation where there is a group that lauds themselves superiorly, and this is not exclusive U.S. at the time in the British Empire when they did their aristocratic thinking, residuals of that would be your Queen Elizabeth. She lives as a queen. She is a queen. She has the palace. All of that excess for a class of people who, by whatever means, seem to have inherited it or earned it by some unknown bloodline, you have a variation of income, a variation of lifestyle. Well, in the United States, unfortunately, we have this duplicity. The whole premise of America is freedom and democracy and everybody's welcome. And the flip side of that, in reality, our social paradigm is a hierarchy very much like the caste system in India, is very much like the aristocratic system, a feudal lord system that existed in Europe in the Middle Ages. I say that because the stratas or strata in the United States is very much financial. And along with the financial falls, the variations of skin color. Immigrants at one time was looked upon as the lower class person coming to the United States. Since America was established for the European and Nordic descent, anyone coming in the late 1700s, early 1800s, were immigrants and not those who had settled the colonies and written the Constitution. And that thinking has continued and even propagated until now. The stigma, if you like, is anyone of color, and then, of course, are the slave descendants, Mexicans or Spanish persons who are coming within the 19th century. And how does this show up? Well, in metropolitan cities, urban areas where jobs are lost for whatever reason, sometimes the car industry crashed, sometimes the steel industry crashed, sometimes it's a migration from those industrialized states and cities back to the southeast. But it turns out that people who have very low incomes, and we're talking about Louisiana, we're talking $12,000 and less a year. That's right, $1,000 a month to live on and raise a family in these United States exists in preponderance. I've met many families making well under $12,000 a year. Then those who have been incarcerated, when they come out, their ability to get employment of any significance is extremely low. Many places, Walmart does not hire an ex-felon. So you will find men who would be heads of household who were incarcerated cannot earn a living for their family, and that makes them very transient. They don't stay in one place for a long time. Their parents are either elderly or don't want them there. The wives are usually looking for someone who has more opportunity. So there's kind of this transient population who are that way because of American circumstances. With all that said, working with this nonprofit group, they have done a superb job in refranchising people. The comment disenfranchised people are those who feel hopeless, can see no way out of their circumstance, insurmountable, overwhelming situations that prevent them from achieving whatever it is they have in their mind. And I looked at a number of requests for proposal of RFPs. They're calling out for those to join in to stem domestic violence, to stop family violence, to prevent date rape. How do you intervene? How do you get to the population who are inflicting this kind of aggression to stop? Well, in all that I read, the persons who are disseminating the funds turn to the wrong groups to give the money. If you're looking at some Ivy League university or some extremely powerful hospital system, you're very likely talking to people who are not involved directly. They may be the recipient of the injured. They may be the persons who counsel after incarceration, but they definitely are not in a position for either intervening or preventing. So what made me write this was that I'm working with this nonprofit group, and they've come up with an amazing model. It is a wonderful paradigm of what to do and how it works and how you both prevent domestic violence by re-educating the male figure, who is the primary perpetrator. Unfortunately, in the statistics, they're saying more than 80% of all of domestic violence are against women. The second victim is the observer of that violence, and children who watch, they may be under the age of 10, they are either inculcating that behavior or they develop post-traumatic stress-like syndromes, and that spins into all kinds of things, alcoholism, promiscuity, drug addictions. So one broken family can spin into 12 to 15 destroyed lives over a lifetime, and that is a very, very, very bad statistic. So in working with this group, I've come to learn their method, and I'm working with them to actually document their model because it, to me, makes so much sense. But for background purposes, for those of you who may be listening to me and haven't really stopped to study what in the world is a social model and why would people even think you can model behavior, well, I'll take a step back and invite you to consider if you are a brother or sister, a husband or wife, or a parent or grandparent, modeling behavior to some of us is very simple. I used to watch my mother can, and she never said a word. She didn't say, first I washed the jar, and then I boiled the jar to sanitize it. No, nothing was exchanged in words, but I was learning nonetheless. I would watch her do what she did, and if I were bold enough, and unfortunate for her, sometimes I was, I may volunteer to do something like reach in and touch one of her mason jar caps before she was able to use it, and she would stare and stare, pick it up and drop it back into boiling water. And what it was saying to me is you can't touch it until a certain time. Never did she put this in words. I can remember looking through a drawer and finding old mason lids and putting them out, hoping she would use them, and she would take the ring but not the rubber seal part. And without saying a word, I understood that if you use that last year, you can't use it again this year. So behavior in primates, and that's what we are, by the way, often is by observation. There does not have to be a single word spoken, just something repeated in action and observed at a young enough age. For those of you who are into animals and say, oh, my dog is my child, consider training the dog. If you want him to speak, you reward it, and you say speak, you reward, and finally you say speak, he knows what you mean, and you get a reward. For those who have service animals, you know that a dog can open a refrigerator, can bring you the phone, can ring a doorbell, can flush a toilet, turn on a light. So behaviors that would not be ordinarily attributed to a dog, especially a service dog, can easily be trained. Well, so is with children. If you're in a family where there's lots of laughter and everyone's loving everybody, that child will be secure and have a sense of trust, and they will have an ability to interact with any social group because their confidence level is very strong. And likewise, if a child's in a family where there's lots of arguing and perhaps some hitting and shoving and pushing around and vile language, that child is learning how to react in a certain situation. So if that situation in the home does not equal what is acceptable in the bigger world, then you have planted a seed in a child that has already ensured his failure. So when we say behavior modification, we're talking about how do we stop that seed from being planted in that innocent? How do we stop the violence being perpetrated onto the victim? And third, how do we stop that person who is behaving in that aggressive manner from ever starting? So when we talk about family violence or domestic violence, we are still in the arena where there can be date violence, because if a young man learns watching his father treat his mother or a loved one, then it's very likely he will treat a female in a similar way. In the institutions that get awarded funds, they're often studying people as if they were lab rats. They put all of these artificial groupings and stand back and observe and then report their findings. And many RFP or requests for proposals actually are asking for the same thing. What are you going to do? How is it going to affect their behavior? How are you going to measure that effect? And what's your outcome? Well, scientifically, that's wonderful, but anyone will say in a social setting, if you keep something that sterile, it's unlikely you can apply it directly to a real living body. So if the United States first started with the rugged individualism where everybody can fail or succeed on their own merit and the government has no obligation in ensuring security of anyone, even those who may be poor, unemployed, or those who cannot work because they're too young or too old or disabled. Well, there was a shift in that thinking, and it's called the progressive movement. I don't know if I call it progressive or not. It was just a rich country ignoring its poor and disabled, and they kind of stemmed some of that and had more benevolent types of programs put in place. But again, these benevolences were put in place in such a way it handicapped people. And I am the first to speak out here in 2015 that the Medicaid or the government support or La CHIP or child welfare has really devastated some of the Black American families that I know, because they are totally dependent. They have no concept of self-sufficiency, and their children has no concept of self-sufficiency, and there's this perpetuation of dependence and, I think, apathy for self. I'm not sure what the solutions are, but I do know that the nonprofit that I'm working with certainly is making a large difference in attitude and expectation, and they're doing it in a very interesting manner. So let's go back to the concept of what is state-sanctioned or institutionalized behaviors for social dynamics. The United States has not followed many of the developed democracies in establishing comprehensive models for assuring citizens' well-being. I'll digress for a moment. When I was working in Colorado there was a number of graduate students at Colorado State that were from Germany, other parts of the country. And during certain periods of the year, relatives would come and visit. And they'd have six, sometimes 12 weeks away from their job and whatever. And they'd be traveling to Grand Canyon and Big Sur in California, Yellowstone Park, and all these different places. And they'd be traveling with children. And I can remember being in their midst and asking the question, how can you take 12 weeks off? And they would say, oh, this is family health that we get from, I don't know if it was Norway or Sweden or Germany, that when a woman went on pregnancy leave, the husband also got family leave, and you could accumulate this time, and they had up to 12 weeks, and they'd do anything from traveling in another country. They'd been to Australia, they'd been to the U.S., they'd been various places, Canada. And this was understood by the government as producing healthy families, giving the adults a chance to be with their children and giving husbands a chance to be with their wives during the welcoming of a new member to their family. So the social support that you see in other countries are not in the form of monthly checks and WIC systems for food. It is comprehensive. It really is. Let there be a unified family. And what I've seen in a lot of the American programs, there is an isolation of the female away from the male. That if I talk to many of the women, men are not allowed to live in their household for them to continue receiving funds. And the flip side, if you talk about Black Americans, a number of Black American men who may have been incarcerated cannot earn sufficient money to support their family. So it's a design of failure that a woman has to be without a man because the man cannot carry the load of the family. So the man's self-esteem is totally eroded because of the Western idea that the man is a very patriotic situation, that he is in charge. And what isn't able to be made up financially, he can't be a CEO or president of a company, then there's a sense of dominance shown by aggression. That if you are my woman, and unfortunately the language is not always clean, and they may refer to their female partner as a female dog, and the concept of ownership elevates him to a position of power. And like everyone, even the corporates, when you say hostile takeovers between these big white-collar companies, the aggression shown there is no different than what would be in a low socioeconomic environment where the man would fight to maintain his property. And if he sees his wife and children or his wife and possessions as possessions, then he will fight with the same tenacity that any Wall Street person would. The net effect, unfortunately, is that it becomes physical and it shows up what is termed as domestic violence, and an awful cycle is set off again. The man is generally demonized or venomized as this monster, and he's back in prison or back in some antisocial dynamic, and the child who had to watch it is burdened with the memory and the potential repeat of same. Okay, with that described, you say, well, how can you interrupt that cycle? Well, just for an aside, if you look at the movements in the United States, the government hasn't been very good at implementing any of these social models. Handicapped Americans actually took over their own position and lobbied Congress and designed their own models until they got what satisfied their needs. And part of their chant and description were, no one can speak for me because they don't know what I have. Why ask someone at Harvard or Yale or Stanford what I need when I'm sitting here looking at you? Ask me. Well, I'm in the position now when I'm working with nonprofits who are very much in the trenches on the grassroots. I think the time has come where we need to stop and ask the very people who we're intending to help. And I'm telling you, those who are listening, that's not what is happening. The grants are written way beyond the heads of those who might be able to respond to you. And those of us who can decipher what you're asking for, discover what you're asking for, is not what is being done on a grassroots level. with all that being said, let me come back to the social models that I've studied and actually went out and did my homework because I wanted to be able to address the issues in the particular grant that I'm working with. There are a few social models which are touted as being effective, and they tell you there's been 800 evaluations, the outcomes have revealed, and when you dissect all of the fluff, all the academic jargon, comes down to one model that they refer to as a family-style model. And I think there was a television program not too long ago where they actually showed a child is rebellious, could be taken from the home of the rebellious parents and put into a home of a very stable family. And this family, essentially like an exchange student situation, took this young person, adolescent, in, told them what the house rules were, expected them to behave as other young people that may be in the household. And I don't know if it took 3 months, 6 months. And they did this instead of sending this a young person to a residential, more punitive setting or law enforcement associated setting, and they're reporting, oh, gee, this works, and it works very well. And all I can do is smile, because that is the paradigm that has always been used in the Black American community before all of the government support came in. My childhood, I was in a subsistence kind of situation, because my father, being a very dominant and intelligent Black man, was very much, hindered. But his hindering had to do with Jim Crow and overt prejudicial behavior in the United States in the South. I mean, he was told that he would not get a job because he was a Black person. Of course, they didn't say it. They used the very derogatory terms that he became very proficient in bricklaying, and there was a situation where someone came and said, I want you to work on this building, but you can't do it during the day. You have to work at night in the dark, because the unions would not like it if they had, and I'll just be kind and say, a Black man working on the job. So he had to work within the restraints of a very, very, very prejudicial environment. And he was able to manage. Now, why am I saying all that? Well, when we had a situation, one that I remember, I was old enough not quite to understand what the word rape meant, but there was this ominous heaviness in the neighborhood. There was a young lady, friends to the family, who had been raped. That was the word. I thought they said raked, and I thought someone had taken an actual lawn rake and injured her. Perhaps she would have survived better. She actually suffered a terrible mental breakdown, but it was a massive rape. It was a racial situation. She was a Black American, and three or four men who raped her were white, and she did get pregnant from the rape, and the child was born. The interesting thing about how it was handled is, of course, the grandmother took the child in, and he was so much lighter in complexion than the rest of the group, so his nickname was Butterball. I mean, no one made it into a big issue other than that was his nickname. He was this high, bright child in the midst of this dark family, and Butterball became the youngest child in that group and was assimilated into the community. There were no post-traumatic stress support for the young lady, and she did not go back to college. This all happened during her first month of her freshman year, She didn't progress. I suspect there was no information. I was probably preteen, so I don't know the depth of it. But she had a nervous breakdown. She never progressed. She never married. And her only child was Butterball. And I think she ended up dying rather young, either with alcohol or drugs. I don't know which. But my point is, the dynamics within the community was assimilating. Let's take him. He's part of us. We're going to do what we have to do. Well, in this family model, it's actually doing the same. It's taking a troubled person out of an environment and put them into a more stable environment. And they said, gee whiz, that person flourishes. Well, the nonprofit I'm working with is using that old-fashioned, classic Black American-type paradigm. And when there is domestic abuse or children observing domestic abuse, or even child abuse, they become assimilated into a healthy environment. And because this nonprofit also has a Christian spiritual background, they create the community in which this group is assimilated. The victims are certainly counseled. The interventions are put in place. The victims removed from that environment. But just as important, this victim and even the perpetrator can be assimilated into a body, a new body. And this new body is made up of this ministry assembly where they are invited to the church meetings, they're invited to group meetings, separate from any court-ordered counseling, separate from any law enforcement-ordered evaluations, until when things all settle, when all is said and done, when the perpetrator has been counseled and the victim has been reassured and the children have been given reestablishment of trust, now they belong to something. They don't go back into an environment that allowed it to happen in the first place. If the man has been incarcerated and he's having difficulty finding employment, then whatever his deficiency, if he needs a GED or the equivalent of a diploma, if he needs a skills training, if he needs to have job placement with a vouching, or if he needs job placement with a bond payment, then this is what this nonprofit organization sets off to do. It's not just one moment in time to go and intervene, to write a report and say, this is what happened, and walk away. This is an investment in the community. This is an I care, and you are just like me. And what is going on is a behavior and not a person. I don't want to tase you until you seize and die. I don't want to shoot you because you seem aggressive and you're looking at me in that aggressive way. It says, you are a human being, and you are a man, you are a woman, just like me. And whatever happened to cause you to step off of that path where love is the first response, I would like to help you find your way. And that particular behavior, from what I can see, is completely unique. I looked at probably a dozen models with all their psychokinetic professors' evaluations. I looked at a various family theory models and all of the expectations of how this works and why it doesn't work. And then I've worked with this particular nonprofit group for probably 3 years, and I've attended their various social dynamics. It's not so structured that someone who is uncomfortable sitting for a long period of time or uncomfortable at having to dress up in a suit, they feel comfortable. They can come in. They can mingle. The music is not so polished and professional that you have to know if you're in middle C or G flat. You can simply pick up a tambourine or you can clap your hands. And there are even times it seems that there's open mic. There are young people who are engaged because they can rap about what's going on. And this particular organization set aside time on Wednesdays or Tuesdays that encourage young people to accumulate and associate and actually do what young people do in a healthy way. There are scheduled times when there's actually just having fun. You're not talking about anybody's mama, and you're not talking about the baby's daddy, and you're not frustrated or comparing. You're just people. And I think, from all I can see, if you're going to adopt a social model that stops or intervenes with domestic and family violence, that you do well to start by being part of that community and not stand back and just assessing from a distance. With that, listeners, I thank you so much for sharing this time with me. And I look forward to next time. But until then, be safe.